Good afternoon. Welcome to Pints with Treebeard. My name is Jameson Winter, and I'm the dean of the upper school at Augustine School here in Jackson, Tennessee. And today I'm joined by Josh Edgren. Josh, tell us about yourself.
Howdy. I'm Josh Edgren. I'm a pastor and teacher in Moscow, Idaho. Jameson, what are we talking about today?
Today we've decided to discuss the importance of reading to your kids. And so this is going to be another Dadcraft episode focused on kind of the practicals and why it matters, what you're actually gaining when you take the work and the time to do this yourself rather than other avenues, you know, giving stories to your children. Because as we were even discussing, you are going to be giving your children stories no matter what. And so the question becomes, will those stories come directly from you, or are they going to come from someone else? And how much overlap is there between those things? So that's what we kind of want to discuss today and think through. Also, welcome back to the show. It's good to have you back. We're both thankful, I know, for Adam pinch hitting last week, and I'm happy to get into this with you. So I wanted to start with just the kind of visceral connection that you create with your kids and that you form with your kids over the years, especially the little years, of course, but that continues if you've set the pattern, especially at that young age. It can continue as they get older. Where, you know, you're reading to 9, 10, 12-year-olds around the dinner table or in the evenings. And I've certainly heard that and experienced some of that maybe with my dad, but I aspire to that with my own kids. So how have you seen in your life that kind of connection grow and flourish by taking the time to read? You know, you get one of your kids up in your lap, they want to read with you, they bring you like 17 books, and they pile them up and tell you the order they want to read them in. What does that do on a spiritual level, on a physical level, for your connection with your children?
Yeah, I appreciate your point that you're always giving stories to your kids. The question is, are you giving them good stories or bad stories? Are you giving them stories yourself, or are you leaving them to fend for themselves and find stories from somewhere else? But stories are unifying things by their very essence. They bring you into something, right? They bring you as the listener into a narrative. And if it's a story that's being shared amongst a community, they bring the community into the same narrative, right? So every culture has its myths. Every culture has its stories, which then unifies and tells the people, the culture, who they are and what it means to be them. And you do that too as a dad on a very small level with your children. You say, these are the stories that define us. Like, these are the stories that shape who we are, and we're going to share them together. So just on a very basic level, when you read to your child, you and the child are entering into a story together. It's a unifying thing, and you're experiencing it at the same time and in the same place, right? And that matters. That's a real thing. That's grounding the two of you there. So reading ought to be a basic assumption of a family's life and culture. Christians are people of the book, so at the very least, you ought to be reading your children the Word of God. But the world is rich with stories, and other stories allow us to understand the one great story better and better. And so you're shaping your children's ability to understand the one story by giving them other little stories. And when you bring them up into your lap, as you say, and you say, we're going to open this together, and I'm going to walk you through it, and I'm going to lead you through it, you are, first of all, taking responsibility for the stories that your child takes in, and secondly, you are the leader, you're the guide for them. This gets practical. You choose the tempo, right? Anyone who's tried to read a three-year-old a book knows the three-year-old wants to turn the pages faster, right, then they ought to. And so you are actually, by sitting there and by reading every word and by changing the page when the time is right, you are training your child to submit themselves to the story, and you're entering into the story together.
That's such a wonderful idea, that you enter into the story together. And it's something that, before we get into the kind of big picture shared mythos and things like that, because that's, I think, something I want to say for a little bit later. When you share these stories together, like you said, you're entering into the world together. And I think there's something there may be many things that we can focus on there with the idea of reading, especially to young children sitting in your lap or sitting next to you, piled all on top of you if there are three or four or five of them, right? That you miss, even if you are still sitting close, right? You know, huddled up on the couch for family movie night. There's a difference there in watching a movie together versus dad reading to us or mom reading to us. And one of the differences is the kids are getting used to your voice, and you are voicing all the characters, you're voicing all the narration. It all comes from you, and therefore you are the source of this good blessing, this good thing for your children. Because in one sense you could say, okay, well, I'm responsible for any movie or show that my kids watch. I'm responsible for any audiobook they listen to. And that's true. And you have a responsibility to monitor those things and make sure they're good stories and to interpret those stories with them. But there's an even deeper component here where you are the actual physical source of what's washing over them, what is entering into their minds. Your vocal cords are vibrating the air that enters into their eardrums and begins to shape their thoughts and their understanding of the world, which is just a beautiful reality, that dad's voice is different than the magic box on the wall.
Yes. Yes. And that's a point to camp on, that we're physical beings. We're incarnate, and necessarily so. And our children, you know, come from our very bodies. That's the way God made it. And everything we do with them is teaching them what is the world, and we're teaching them what is the world through not just propositions. Son, this is a soft thing. Say after me. No, but you're touching it, right? Now touch it and you feel it. And this is what this is. This is a bitter thing. This is a, you know, beautiful thing. And let me tell you why. It's all incarnate. It's all physical. And so, no, I think you're exactly right to emphasize that. When your child's on your lap and their little body is vibrating with your big body as you are, you know, reading the voice of the bear, right? And they're hearing you breathe, and they're experiencing the story, you're not just giving them ideas, you're giving them a world, right? You're giving them what a bear is ideologically, but what a bear sounds like, what a bear feels like, and you're giving that to them. You're exactly right, in a way that you don't get with Family Movie Night, as good as Family Movie Night is, and in a way that you don't get with most other media that you consume. So it's reading to your children is a deeply embodied thing, and that's not to be skipped over lightly.
And it's easy to skip over, which is maybe our problem and really one of the points of this episode, because it's so tempting to take one of the easier avenues that technology has allowed us, or to just say no and do something else because I don't want to read Fox and Socks for the 17th time. Which is ridiculous, because
if you don't want to read Fox and Socks, then I mean, do you even have a soul? Everyone wants to read Fox and Socks.
Yeah, I agree. That's one of my favorite children's books to read. It's just a blast. And so I picked that because really you're showing your hard-heartedness if you don't want to read Fox and Socks. But that's true. Amen. Even of the stories that maybe we don't prefer to read. I can think of several of them, but my kids might want me to read them. And okay, if I really have a problem with it, I need to remove it from the home. Right. If I don't want to read it because I don't think this story is good for you, then I should remove it. But if it's good for you and I just don't happen to enjoy reading it, well, that is, once again, like every other area of parenting, an opportunity to die to myself and my self-interest, my own selfish desires. And it's so easy to skip that part and to think, again, really, this story, or I've already read you three stories in a row. And obviously there are times where you say, okay, it's dinner time. We can't keep reading, or I need to go cut the grass and you need to go play outside. And that's natural. But when you've got the time and the space for it and you say no, oftentimes that, at least in myself, I have found has been motivated by selfishness and my own unwillingness to do the hard work of reading a story and reading it well.
Two things kind of as an aside almost. One being a point that you made, if you don't want to read, if there's a book that you don't want to read to them because it's not a good book, get rid of it. and get a good book. There's tons of good books. This is actually a place where you don't have to be unselfish in a way, right? You actually can make it so that the only books you have are books you like to read. And that's actually not a bad thing. That's not a, I mean, maybe if you're being dumb and you're saying, like, we only have to read books about, you know, the Green Bay Packers, right? That may be not so good. But the point is, give them good stories. Give them good things. And they will love what you love. So if you enjoy reading it, that is contagious. And that's, I think, another point that the magic box, the speaker, can't get. Right? It can't communicate your love for the thing. It can communicate someone else's love for the thing. And you can say, like, oh yeah, I really like that story. But the enthusiasm that you would bring, that you, right, in an incarnational way are telling your child, I love this thing, you should love it too, right? That's potent.
It is potent. And in that way, that kind of clicks into place for me something that we mentioned before recording, which is that you were talking about this idea that you read some of the stories on canon, and playing those is kind of weird because you're reading it and you could just be physically reading it. And I've thought about this idea of, you know, leaving a trove of stories recorded for your kids or your grandkids, maybe especially grandkids and hopefully great grandkids, right? That would be the time when they were needed because you've passed on. You're no longer here to be able to physically read it. And I think I first had that idea when I listened to Tolkien reading The Lord of the Rings for the first time and thought, man, this is so special that it's not like I know Tolkien. I can't actually go back and meet him, but to hear his voice reading the story, there's something special there. And I think in a similar way, that would be a gift to kids, grandkids, great-grandkids. And yet in the moment, if I were to record, say, Crispin's Rainy Day, and anytime Levi wants to read that, I just play it for him from my phone. Well, that's selling him short, and that's a cheap way out. And he would recognize that because I don't love the story enough to read it again and to exert the energy and the thought and the time. And that's an easy story to read, but you can apply it to any story. And in one sense, I don't love him enough in the moment to read it again and to take the effort. And so I think there's something important there to recognize that when we read these stories again and again, it's not just our love for the story that's being communicated. It's our love for the kids, because they pick up on the fact that Dad has read these stories from James Herriot dozens of times. Dad has read Brambley Hedge dozens of times, and he's willing to do it again for my sake, because I can't read it. And I need him to read it to me. And I want to look at the pictures and experience the story again. And he's always there willing to do it. It's just a gift that we give our kids. And I think a sense of security and blessing that we give them.
No, agreed. Absolutely. Reading the same books over and over again is not a problem. Like that's actually a good thing. That's a blessing. When the kids are really young, especially, they need and crave familiarity, right? They need to know that the world is consistent. And they need to see the same things over and over again. And they love to see the same things over and over again. It's weird as an adult when we are so accustomed to the world being pretty fixed. And so we desire novelty. But to see, like, no, actually the thing they're looking for is familiarity. It's exciting for them when things are where you put them. Which actually makes total sense, because most of their lives things are not where they put them. You know, like it's just this constantly changing thing that they don't get to control.
Yeah. And they recognize it, right? That's an interesting thought, because I had not considered before. You're giving them this story again, and it's one of the few things in their lives that's not new to them as they grow and experience the world. We get into these routine patterns, like you said, as adults, but they just haven't lived long enough to really have that grounding in the world. And so when my son is familiar enough with a book that before he can read, he can correct me if I say the wrong word accidentally, he notices those things because he's familiar enough with the story. And that's exciting to him that he knows it that well.
I've never thought about this before, but I think here's a way to imagine that. Imagine moving to a new town where you know nobody, right? And so the chance of you running into someone you know is virtually nil. Now imagine the excitement when you do happen to run into like the one other person you know there. That's, whoa, like that's an exciting thing. Like, wow, hey, you, I recognize you. And the familiarity is exciting. Like, I think that's what it's like for kids to read a book they know. Like, the familiarity is exciting. Like, oh, I know this one. I got this. So that's a blessing. And then the other thing is it's a good thing if your child wants to read far more than you want to read. Like, that's a good thing. That's a sign that they desire closeness, that your presence is comforting to them, that they trust you to interpret the world to them, that they are curious and want to understand, and they want to share stories with you. So if you are finding that, boy, oh boy, they would read all day. Like, they would just go get another stack of books until I fall asleep. Like, that's a good thing. That's normal. That's you know, buckle up, but that's normal.
And that kind of consistency is actually the larger point, because there is this intimate connection and this kind of visceral reaction for a father or mother and a child to be reading together. But it goes beyond just the kind of physical visceral connection. It goes into an interpretation of the world, like you said. And how I've kind of thought about this is, you're giving your children, by exposing them to the same stories or the same kinds of stories, you're giving them common language to understand the world. You're giving them patterns of meaning to understand all of the different behaviors that they see or that they enact in the world, and to give them this kind of vocabulary to name those things. You should be seeking to cultivate a kind of familial mythos, right? Like, these are the winter household stories. Not that I wrote them, but that these are the ideas, these are the concrete concepts that we use to interpret the world.
And you will inevitably have them. It's just a matter of whether they're good or bad, right? Whether they're helpful or lame. There will be a winter family mythos. There will be a winter family, you know, set of core texts. The question is, what are they?
Yeah, and this is something that Chesterton gets at, right? When he talks about people who don't want to read stories with dragons and monsters and witches and warlocks because it might scare children. And he says, well, they're living in a world with all of those things. And so if they live in that world, let them at least have heard of brave knights. And that's what we want to give to our children on a kind of practical side, is you need to be able to tie good and evil to characters and to archetypes. There's a reason that archetypes are a thing. It's the first type, the first pattern. And it's the way that you understand what wickedness truly is, or what nobility and courage and mercy and faithfulness truly is. It's by giving them characters and images and events, plot points, right? Like, it's not a bad thing if you read a story and your son recognizes that, oh, this knight is gonna slay the dragon. That's a good thing. You've given him a mythos where he anticipates reality as it should be. And there might also be tragic stories, right, where that doesn't happen. That can be the case, but what you don't want to do is to have him reading a story of a brave knight and think, oh, this guy's doomed, right? He's toast. This is never going to work,
right?
Because you're teaching him the wrong thing if those are the only kinds of stories you read.
This is just anecdotal, but this is an example of this playing out in my family just today. We had family movie night last night, and we watched Kung Fu Panda, which actually is a film that I have grown to appreciate more and more as time goes on. But we can maybe talk about that more later. And that has been a surprise to me. But this morning, as we're sort of debriefing the film and talking about it again, kids have seen it before, we're talking about it again, and Benaiah says, you know, Tai Lung, he wanted the dragon scroll so much that he became the dragon. And I was like, yes, that is correct. That is exactly right. And so you're using this idea of the dragon, like the thing that must be killed, the thing that must be defeated. And you are able to now apply that in a story with no dragons.
That's the exact language that we actually use with our kids. It works now that we have a daughter too. Rosemary's going on 8 months, right? So now the boys don't just have this hypothetical concept of protecting a princess, although they've done that some with Megan, right? But still, she's so much bigger than them. They kind of get, am I really protecting you? Like, you could protect me because I'm 2 feet tall, maybe. But anyway, they get this reaction or this interaction with Rosemary where they want to play games where they're protecting her from me. And they want me to crawl across the floor and roar and try to attack her. And they can run and jump and tackle me and hit me with swords and get on my back and put me in a chokehold. And it's great. And when they're being foolish and when one of them jumps off the couch and lands right next to her head and we say, whoa, that's wrong. You can't do that. Or when one of them gets upset with her for some reason, like she's crawling and knocks down their magnetiles, we have to teach them, hey, what's your job? Your job is to protect her, to be a brave knight. Your job is not to be a dragon. Right now, if you're getting upset with her, you're being foolish, you're putting her in danger, you're being a dragon. And now we actually need to protect her from you. And you don't want to do that. Right. And they understand that language because they love reading about St. George and the Dragon.
Yeah, that's a great example of establishing vocabulary that you can then use in the ethical and moral formation of your children. This is what the world is, but you give them that understanding of dragons by reading stories about dragons. This is maybe an aside. Maybe we don't even have to get into it. What do you think about stories, sort of, I don't know, maybe more modern, whimsical stories where the dragons are good? Like, do you think those are problematic?
Yeah, I go back and forth on this, and I think in moderation, I'm okay with it because it's actually something where I can train the boys to think of it as silly and as a joke.
Yes.
And that's fine. I was kind of turned on to this by someone else in our church, and he said, you know, he kind of lamented that all the dragons are good in the stories these days. And kids aren't getting this kind of archetypal bad guy, which is not just random either, right? Dragons are serpents. There's a reason that dragons are chosen in mythology around the world, in various cultures and contexts, to be these wicked, princess-capturing, town-devouring, fiery beasts. And it's because there's enmity between man as following God and man as following the serpent. And so I do think that we have to protect that mythos in some respect, but also there is a place for some kind of trite, whimsical, silly story about a dragon or a goblin being good. So for instance, you know, there's this little kid's book, Nobody Likes a Goblin, and the adventures come into, there's actually a funny kind of trope that they're writing into the story about common D&D players, because party of wizards and rogues and things comes into the dungeon. The goblin is just minding his own business, playing with his friend Skeleton in the dungeon, and all the gold is there. And the Skeleton was a king, and so he has a crown, and the goblin's, you know, pretending to be the Goblin King. And they come in and they take everything, including the Skeleton. It is something that I can point at with the boys and laugh at, right? I can say, isn't this so silly that the goblin is the good guy here and he's going to find his friend? And they're like, yes, that's so silly. But I want to be careful with that because, you know, there's some danger there that they start to see orcs and dragons and wolves and goblins as the good guys.
No, I think you're right. I think within moderation, that's fine. As long as there's a bedrock of good and evil that they have, it's deeper. But I think there's also, there's secondary truths, right? So there's the truth that is the dragon should be slain. And there's also the truth that sometimes you can't kill the dragon. Like sometimes there's reasons why you can't. And so you have to live in a world where you can't kill the dragon. Or like we live in worlds where things that aren't dragons look like dragons sometimes. And so we have to also navigate in that. Have you read Farmer Giles of Ham?
No, I've read Smith of Wootton Major, and so I have the book, you know, the volume that has both in it, but I've only read Smith of Wootton Major.
They're both great. If you have to pick, read Smith of Wootton Major, but since you don't have to pick, you should also read Farmer Giles of Ham. But in that one, he defeats the dragon, but it is this sort of whimsical, light, but also very realistic tale where he doesn't kill the dragon. He makes the dragon walk home with all the treasure strapped to his back. And then when the dragon gets home, he uses the dragon as leverage over the king. And then eventually, when they're both old and, you know, wealthy and powerful, he releases the dragon. And they part on good terms, right? And so there's this, like, those are also true. Those are also real. That shouldn't be the child's bedrock, but that also is a real thing. Back to the concept of a family mythos or a family vocabulary. that is something that was present in my household growing up. Like my parents both read to us all the time. So I was homeschooled. The curriculum that my mother chose to take us through was heavy literature based, and it was heavy on read alouds. And so she would read to us, you know, all afternoon, most days until I was, you know, in high school. Like that was, and then I started doing it on my own. But so there was this fundamental, like, part of my life that was mom reads to us, and that's how we understand the world. But then my dad also read to us, and so that was the fun stuff, though. So like he would read Narnia to us, and he would read there was a particular Canadian author that they loved who wrote humorous stories about you know junior high kids, and we read all of those, and that, you know, provided one look at the world. And then my dad read The Hobbit to us, and all sorts of other books. And so that, but then of course we would circle back and read all of those again and again and again. And so Narnia and these humorous books and The Hobbit would be this sort of body that bound us all together. And we would have ice cream, and it was all tied up with the best parts of life. And that was rich. And it's not only giving, you know, it's not only giving you tools for ethical and moral formation, although that is true. It's also just to share good things with your kids, and so that you all are in on the joke.
And in that vein, it allows your children to have these common expressions of play. It gives them stories to act out in their pretend, which is what I did all the time as a kid. I mean, I remember for hours upon hours going outside, finding sticks, sharpening them on the driveway. You know, you ever do that where you drag the stick on the driveway to get a nice good point? Where you could actually poke
Oh, no, I didn't have a driveway.
Okay, well, yeah, on the driveway, on the road, whatever, you find a rock somewhere, and you can sharpen your stick, and it's a nice spear. It'll stick in the ground if you throw it now.
We would use surveying sticks. We just find those and salvage those.
yeah, nice. There are no surveying stakes in my neighborhood growing up, but we did have a driveway, so that's what we used. And I would go out and play Lord of the Rings all the time. And, you know, that's a mix of my dad reading The Hobbit to me as a kid and reading some of Narnia to me as a kid, and then also seeing those movies at an early age. And the chain link fence in our backyard was obviously the wall of Helm's Deep. And the gate there was obviously where the orcs blow up the wall. And I would just swing at them for hours, right? And I would kick them off the wall. I would topple the ladders when they try to climb up. It was what I played because it's the story that I knew. And it's so fun to see Levi and Ezra now doing that, and Rosemary soon. Because Megan just told me just yesterday, maybe, or a couple of days ago, for about 5 to 10 minutes solid, he was running around the backyard yelling, "Oh, Tom Bombadil is a merry fellow. Bright blue his jacket is, and his boots are yellow." And he just kept yelling it again and again, which is the exact kind of thing that I think Tom Bombadil would love to see.
Of course.
Yeah, giving them an avenue to play and to create their own stories from the stories you've given them is essential.
Yeah, no, agreed. And it allows them to do what they will be doing for the rest of their life, which is taking things and then reassembling them and putting them back together again, right? It allows them to exercise creativity, but you always exercise creativity with what God made, right? So you take what you're given, and then you insert yourself into it. That's almost too basic of a human thing to even give an example of where we do it, but that idea of sub-creation, that we take what we are given, we mix it with ourselves, and we put it back a little bit different, right? I'm not saying that fan fiction ought to be encouraged, but that's getting at something. Like, I see beauty, I see truth, I see goodness. I don't want to just see it. I want to be part of it. How do I be part of it? And that's what our kids are doing when they play like that.
Yeah, that's right. And that's why it's essential, as we've mentioned, that you must be interpreting these stories for them. You must be helping them understand the stories. It's not enough to simply read the story. You have to coach them and help them to see what's often there, and they maybe recognize a part of it, but they don't know how to name it. So when we watch Cars, or when we read about a book with a character who's struggling and then becomes good at the end, Levi especially will often ask questions about why he's doing what he's doing. And it's not enough to just say, oh, listen to the story, you'll find out. Well, no, he really won't,
right,
unless I tell him. I need to see, or I need to show him, this is vainglory. This is pride. This is selfishness. This is so on and so on, right? This is anger. And he's changing his anger into tenderness. He's changing his pride into humility, or maybe someone is changing his pride into humility for him in a given story, right? So let's maybe go into that, thinking about the craft of storytelling and reading stories to our kids. And we can maybe start there with interpreting, but how do you actually build this skill of reading to your kids in a way that keeps them coming back for more?
Yeah, jumping in on just what you were just describing, it's a skill to be able to read and understand a story, and that's a skill that your children don't have. They're not born with it, and they need to be taught. They need to be taught how to recognize things. So that goes back to what we were saying before, right? Having archetypes, so dragon, princess, knight, okay, there you go. But now we need to practice recognizing them. And stories that are worth reading are going to be complex, are going to have nuance, and it's not necessarily going to be obvious what character is which archetype, and like you said, they can change, and that's the whole point, right, of a redemption story. It's, you know, a dragon turning into a human, right? It's Eustace becoming a real boy, right? Becoming a true boy, I should say. So the impulse to just read and let the story do the work when they're young is unrealistic and unloving. The laziness that we often have of, like, I don't want to try to explain to you why a fawn is here in the woods and what a fawn is and why it's significant that he has packages and what and why they say Father Christmas instead of Santa Claus, or, you know, like, I don't want to explain it, so I just won't, right? But then, first of all, if a story is complex and worth reading, it's going to have parts that aren't in their vocabulary. If all the words are in their vocabulary, what was the point of reading it, right? Yeah. So it's going to always have things that are outside their world, and so you need to be guiding them and saying, "This, hey, this thing is outside your world, but let me give you access to it." And then, even if it is all inside their world, it's nuanced, it's complex, and so we have to do the hard work of stopping and answering their questions, letting them ask questions. Ooh, that's a good one.
Yeah.
Right? Because as dads, we can create a culture where question asking is verboten, right? And the kids just know, don't ask, because he's gonna shush you. And of course, kids sometimes need to be shushed. But creating an atmosphere where the kids know they can ask questions, because you want them to do that with the scriptures, so you have to enculturate that in the other things you read too.
Yeah, I mean, just on that note, one of the things I try to teach Levi is just, hey, pause for a second. Don't interrupt the middle of the sentence, but wait for a little pause to jump in. And that can be hard for, I mean, he's 3, he's about to turn 4. That can be hard for him to know when he's just listening. He's not reading, obviously. He doesn't know what a period is. And so I show grace there, but then I say, okay, wait just a second. And let me finish this sentence or the last couple of sentences of this paragraph. And, you know, I go back to reading. And then I say, okay, now that we've completed the thought, what's your question? Because I know that the question might take us on a 5-minute excursus into something totally different, but that does actually pertain to the story.
And praise
the
Lord if it does.
Right, exactly. So I want to get through this little dialogue moment so that we can jump back in and it makes sense and we're not picking up mid-sentence. One of the things that I think is essential is just to have the kind of inward patience to continue doing this, right? To continue reading, to continue persevering. And again, it goes back to having stories that you want to read, having stories that you enjoy reading. Yep. That will be a blessing to your kids. But one of the ways that I have been able to kind of cultivate that in myself and have been able to motivate myself in the moments where I'm tired and don't want to read is to remember the basic reality that as parents we're all trying to reckon with, which is that we have so few of these moments in reality. I mean, we were talking maybe episode one or two, that your time with Benaiah in your house, Lord willing, will be much smaller than the time you have to share as adults together, as men, one to another.
Right.
And we don't think that way we think in the moment that this period of childhood, or even just childhood in general for our kids, will continue indefinitely, but it just won't. And so remembering there's going to be a day where Levi gets in my lap for the last time to read a story. And I don't know when it is, and he doesn't know when it is. And so I'm going to make the most of this, right? That's a big motivating factor. If, again, you really love these stories and want to love your kids by sharing them.
A question that is so helpful, or a rhetorical question that is so helpful when I'm tempted to be impatient or frustrated. For me, the pressure point for me is after I put the kids to bed and they come out and ask for things. Like, that one strikes a nerve. But the question that I ask myself is, okay, 20 years from now, how much would you pay to have this moment again? You know, like, oh man, what is really frustrating to me right now? And like, to have that, you know, sweet little pajama clad child at the top of the stairs asking me to get them a drink of water or telling me they're scared. Like, oh man, it's really frustrating right now. But 58-year-old me, how much would he pay? Oh man, he'd pay big. And I'm like, okay, well, I need to savor this for his sake then. You know?
On that note, there's this idea came to me differently and is maybe of practical benefit for someone out there. That I don't remember even what the context was, but somebody somewhere had posted about this kind of nice edition of some book that they had, and their kids scribbled all over one or two of the pages with a marker. And maybe it was even a Bible, I don't know. And they're like, I just don't know what to do with it. Like, I've just spent money on this and now it's ruined and I got to get a new one or whatever. And all of the comments were parents who have gone beyond that stage saying, don't you dare get rid of it, because you're going to read this in 40 years and you're going to forget that the scribbles are there, and you're just going to weep when you see it. You're going to be so grateful, yeah, for your kids. And so that just struck me. It wasn't even something that I was talking about, right? I just happened to see it somewhere and it just struck me, man, the little, like you said, the little frustrations, how much would I pay to have them back when I'm 58, when I'm, you know, 70. And that's a physical, tangible reminder of one that's so beautiful. So if you have any scribbled in books, keep them. Don't get rid of them. Don't replace them.
Going back to what we were saying before, the goal when you're reading is to have an atmosphere where any true legitimate question about the text is welcomed, invited, and will be taken seriously and engaged with. And distracting questions or other questions about other things that show that their mind is wandering are not acceptable. Those are not allowed, right? So we do have to still have to train them, right? And it's not just they can say whatever while we're reading. Like, no. This is a thing that is sacred in a way. And so I'm only accepting questions about this thing. But any true question about this thing will be met with respect, will be met with joy. And the motivator for that is it doesn't take long before your kids are making connections to other stories where they're putting things together. And that is about the best. Like, that's just about the richest pleasure when you get the sense like it's working. We're doing it. They're getting it. And they're making the connections on their own. It's just wonderful. So you hold on to those moments and that you let that motivate you.
And one thing that could maybe, as a practical tip, help us to cut with the grain there is to recognize when minds are wandering, and depending on the age and depending on the context, saying, okay, it may be time to start wrapping up here. Levi, as I said, is 3, about to turn 4. And so there are times we read Lord of the Rings each night before bed, 2-3 pages maybe. There are times where we read it in the afternoon, and I might read more to him and to Ezra. And during the middle of the day, when you can get out of bed and go play, you're more distractible. And so there are times where I recognize, okay, it seems like they're asking about something totally different or thinking about something totally different. Maybe it's time to wind down. And I read to the end of the paragraph and then we press pause. And if they want to pick it back up in 10 minutes, we can. But if they want to go and play, great, let them, because then you keep it. It's kind of like the notion of ending any kind of event or experience, leaving your audience wanting more. right? You don't want to make it drudgery for them. You don't want to make it something that they have to endure. Like, oh, Dad's got the Lord of the Rings out again. We're going to sit here for 30 minutes on the couch by George and nobody's going to be able to move. Like, that's not right. Cultivating the love that I want it to cultivate. And so don't approach it that way.
That's exactly right. One thing I wanted to touch on that maybe goes unsaid between us, but that our listener might hear and go like, what? He's reading Lord of the Rings to his four-year-old? Wait, his almost four-year-old? Like, what a monster. Or maybe he has exceptionally bright children. Wow, huh, gee, goody for him, right? So something I want to touch on because, you know, we did that too, right? We actually, you sent me a beautiful copy of The Lord of the Rings, and I thought to myself, this is too good not to share. And so I started reading it to Benai and Rose when they were, yeah, 3 and 5, and we, you know, it took us 14 months, but we read the whole thing, and, you know, 2 pages a night. That's a thing that actually, if done well, builds joy and not crushes it. And so a couple of points there that I think are really, really important. Your children are capable of more than you think they are pretty much always, right? Unless you're being stupid and just, you know, assuming that they're rocket surgeons or something. But almost always, your children are capable of more than you think if you're willing to do the work of raising them up, right? If you're willing to explain things to them. And sure, they may not be able to engage with it as deeply as they will when they're 11 or 12 or 13 or 38 or whatever, but they can engage with it. And when you see that, and when you've pushed them to do something hard, like engage with a story that's above them, that's beyond them, they have success, they have triumph, and that's exciting. And then it's this thing that you're sharing together. And, you know, so my children cried when Boromir died. When Gandalf came back, you know, Rosie got up and danced around the room. You know, when Theoden died, the kids were sad, but, you know, they reflected back on Boromir's death and they said, you know, I think Benaiah said, but well, he died with honor. That's a good thing. Right. And so it's rich if you're willing to do the work. So it's not absurd to give children stories that are beyond them. That's actually good and loving if you're willing to follow it up with lots of exposition.
And almost from the time that they can talk, maybe just from the time that they can talk, I think you can read them pretty much anything and they'll get something out of it, right?
Yeah.
And that
yeah.
doesn't mean you should read them anything, but anything good, wholesome, beautiful, they're going to get something out of it because think about what your child has just done. They've gone from not being able to make sounds, or at least not articulate sounds, to being able to use language to express thought. And that's what we're doing when we read. It's a bigger jump to go from none of that to mama, may I have more, than it is to go from mama, may I have more to, and Aragorn walked with the fellowship through whatever, right? They might not get 20% of the words that you're saying, but they're still going to be tied to characters. They're going to be tied to ideas. Like, Levi gets a lot more than Ezra. Again, he's running around singing about Tom Bombadil in the backyard. Ezra will do that in mimicry of him, but he doesn't do it yet fully because he understood the story, right? But he does recognize character names. He recognizes some of the places. He recognizes when people are fighting in the story. And he'll say things like, why he fight him? And those are questions that you can engage them with, right? And help them to understand as much as they can.
And even if all you're doing is training them to listen to your voice, if all you're doing is saying, I want to be with you for 20 minutes, if all you're doing is saying, this is a thing our family does, like if that's all they get out of it, that was worth it. Like even if they got nothing out of the story, they knew that you wanted to be with them. They knew the sound of your voice for 20 minutes. They knew that your family does this thing. And that's all gold.
Yeah. One thing, it's maybe not a funny anecdote, maybe a funny group of anecdotes because it's happened so much, is that you, if you're reading consistently to your kids and you're pushing yourself to read even when you're tired and you're coming home from work or whatever, you'll run into things where you fail in some way, and that's okay, right? That's part of building the habit. So there are times where I am reading to the boys and I start to recognize, wait a minute, I've been drifting off to sleep and I've been saying random words in the middle of these sentences. And Levi will say something like, what do you mean St. George got in the car to buy milk? That doesn't make sense. And he, like, that's not the story. And I wake up startled and think, oh, you're right, I'm falling asleep. And there's a time there to call it quits too, right? There's a time to say, okay, I will get down on the floor and wrestle with you because sitting here right now is putting me to sleep. But those things happen, right? And so push through them and be okay with that. That in some way is kind of endearing. And it's building that kind of fellowship and familial intimacy.
You're exactly right. And that's great. I think that as a general rule of thumb, if you're falling asleep reading to your children, that is a mark that your life is well ordered. Like that's a good sign if that is happening. It is also one of the most excruciating feelings. You know, it's not as bad as falling asleep while driving. You know, like I desperately need to close my eyes, but I cannot. But it's almost as bad. And we've all done it, and it is as you say, it's endearing, and it's a sign that you're living rightly.
Yeah, I mean, one of my friends in high school asked somebody, an older man in our church, if it was a sin to read as you're going to bed and to fall asleep while reading the Bible, and because you're like not paying attention. I think his concern was I'm being irreverent or something like that. And he just kind of paused and looked at us and said, you know, I can't think of a better way to fall asleep, honestly. And that's kind of my thought on it as well. Like I'm tired, I'm falling asleep into this short nap. And I can't think of a better way to do it than reading with my kids and having them in my arms. And then, you know, it doesn't last long because they say, hey, those are not the words, or why did you stop reading?
Yeah, yeah.
Like Levi has elbowed me sometimes.
That's what mine do. Yeah.
And said, hey, why did you stop? Can you keep going, please? And then you wake up and you're like, okay, yeah.
Baba. Yeah. As we're finishing up, as we're wrapping up here, what are your tool tips, right? So like nitty gritty, what are things you've learned? Give us a tool tip with regards to reading to the kids.
Yeah. I think a couple just kind of randomly, the first ones that come to mind is when you have really little kids, Ezra's kind of come out of this now, but he was again, young enough as a 2-year-old. Early on that he would be turning the pages all the time, and he'll still do it sometimes, but he would be reaching for them, grasping for them. So just hold the book where he can't reach, right? And, you know, if you're reading to him and to Levi at the same time, hold it out here in front of you and read it from afar and teach him, you know, if he gets fussy, teach him, this is not a time to fuss, right? I'm reading with you. This is a good thing. You wanted to read this story even. And so we're going to read it. And this is what we're going to do. So not letting the toddler be a tyrant and flip the pages and interrupt the story because it ruins it, not only for him, but for anybody else who's listening. That's a good one.
Okay. I've got one. Maybe this goes without saying, but do all the voices. Like do all the voices. Commit. And if you're reading a story that's long, remember the voices you choose. And that's hard work, but do it. It's worth it. You remember your dad doing it, hopefully. And you loved it, even when the voices were weird. And also be very careful what voices you pick, because you got to be able to keep them up. Man, I chose a Gollum voice one time that I could not stick with, and we had to alter. And there you go.
Well, you took my second one. I was going to say do the voices. I think there's also the idea of when you have multiple kids who want to read with you, recognizing you can't read the same thing to all of them. And not all of them are interested in the same thing. And so just alternate, right? Take turns. And there are different ways that you can do that and even different ways to do it at different times. So when Ezra was younger and reading just board books, or I say reading, really, I would just pick him up in my lap and we would read board books. And eventually he learned to bring them up to us, right? I would read those with him, and sometimes I would just read to him for a little while Levi was playing contentedly. Other times I would just read to Levi while he was playing contentedly, and we'd read the bigger books, Brambly Hedge and those sorts of things. But then so often, especially as Ezra got a little bit older, we would just alternate, like let each kid pick a book and switch between them. And, you know, you take a turn, you take a turn, you take a turn, you take a turn, and keep going. And that way you make sure to expose them to stories that they're interested in the moment, but you also you know, you're teaching the older kids in the moment to love their younger siblings by reading this book that maybe is a little beneath them at this point, or that they don't really get excited about like they used to. And then you're shaping the younger kids by giving them more than they can handle, in one sense, like you said, and stretching them and giving them a little bit of extra kind of vocabulary and mythos that allows them again to engage with their siblings in that way.
Another tip, when the kids are really little, they want to read picture books forever and ever and ever. When they get a little older, especially if you're then trying to read something that's more interesting to you, maybe less interesting to them, or that you have to get over a hump before it's interesting to them, do what you can to make the reading time as special and pleasant as possible, right? Cut with the grain, don't cut against the grain, right? Don't say, I know it's Saturday morning and it's a beautiful day outside and you want to be playing, but too bad, time to read, right? Sit on the couch, stay inside. Like, no. Like, have it be, this is the biggest one for us, and I don't think it can be beat. Have it be something where they get to stay up late.
Yes.
Like, that's a winner. It's a winner. So doing it at bedtime, doing it with dessert, doing it after dinner, whatever. If they understand, like, ooh, we, by rights, should be asleep right now, but we're not.
Yeah.
Right? That's cutting with the grain of their motivations, and that will just make it feel all the more special to them, and you'll be more successful at building family culture around it.
Yeah, I mean, and you help them cultivate, especially if you're doing that from when they're young, a love for reading and a love for having you read to them, because this is how we got through The Hobbit with Levi in a year or less, probably a little less, because he was 19 months older than Ezra. He is 19 months older than Ezra, I should say.
Is he really? Is he still?
He's still that much older. But, you know, he's 19 months when Ezra's born, so probably right before he turned 2, and we're starting to put Ezra down and at night, and they're going to bed in the same room together. Ezra's not in our room anymore. So right around the time he turned 2, I started keeping him up, and Megan would go and put Ezra down, and we would read for 5-10 minutes in The Hobbit. And he had some staying power, because this is the first time he's ever gotten to stay up late, and he recognizes somebody else has to go to bed before me. And he loved it. And so now we've kind of transitioned where it's not exactly like that anymore, but it's both of the boys together in their bunk bed reading with me before they go to sleep, and they love it.
Yeah, no, that's right. That feels like a superpower as a dad. Like, I have the bedtime wand.
Yeah.
And I can make the world magical by just removing that requirement.
I control time and space for you.
That's right, that's right. I kind of already said this before, but yeah, pick stuff you love. Pick stuff that's lovely. You know, make it be a beautiful edition of the book. Show them that it's meaningful. Show them that it's special, that it's precious. Have a special place you keep it. Have them be the ones, have a child be the one to go get the book for you. Anything that builds sort of ritual into it and makes you all take it more seriously. That's all on the side of the angels.
I think a note that goes to interpretation and kind of expositing the books for your kids or with your kids is to learn how to ask thoughtful questions about what characters are doing or saying, and to pause to actually ask those questions. So this is what, you know, St. George does, or this is what Sir Gareth does at this moment. Is he being courageous? Is he being cowardly? Is he honoring God? Is he dishonoring God? Asking those questions and then letting them respond and talking through that with them is super helpful, because like you said earlier, they will jump from that to applying ideas to multiple stories and to other stories and kind of combining the stories together and comparing them much more easily if they're already used to answering questions about the stories. And I'm not talking about quizzing them and making them answer all of these different factual things, but helping them to see that what the characters are doing are teaching us something about how to live or how to not live, and making it real for them in that way.
Yeah, jumping off of that, sometimes not answering their questions right away. But they ask a question and you say, great question, what do you think?
Mm-hmm.
And that does several things. It teaches them that their question matters. It also teaches them to not just demand the easy response, but to actually, I should do the spade work of thinking about it for myself. Also, it treats them with dignity and respect and tells them that they matter and that their thoughts matter and that they're important and that you value them and that you value their thoughts. And then also it builds them in them the muscle of engaging with a text seriously and probing. And then you get to see how much they retained.
Right.
And you get to see how much they understood. You get to sound them out, which you could just answer their question and say, yeah, it's this. But if you say, this has happened to me so often, if you say, yeah, great question, what do you think? And then they say, well, it could be this. They open up this whole other avenue that you could go down, because probably they didn't have the right answer, but they probably had an insight that you didn't know they had, and that it, you just now invited, you've just been invited in to their world and to tinker around. And it's yeah. So that's a wonderful, also it gives you a moment to pause and think about it.
You get to come up with your own answer. Clever.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. That's all tactics.
That's
also, that works in the classroom too.
I was going to say that's essential to teaching students in classical schools, right? Using the Socratic method and engaging them in dialectic. I tell my students every year at the beginning of literature, this class is very easy to pass. It's also very easy to fail. And to fail, all you have to do is read the book every night, show up to class, and say nothing. Because I don't know what you're thinking, and I don't care if you read the book if you're not talking about it with us. The purpose of the class is to help you learn how to engage in conversation about what you're reading. And so you've got to engage in conversation. You know, if you're shy, you're going to have to work on that, and I'll help you, right? I'm not just like a tyrant, you know, beating them over the head with zeros or anything, but I want to cultivate this kind of courage to get out of their comfort zones when there's, you know, 15 kids in class and you don't know if you have the right idea. And I tell them, you know, you don't have to have the right idea. You just need to have an idea. I want to know what you think and what your interpretation of the story is, not because it's equally valid with the correct interpretation, but because I can see how you get there and then maybe steer you back towards truth and goodness and beauty. Or I can see that you are there and have you kind of help a classmate who's struggling to understand why this character did something. It's so important, to ask the students in the classroom and also to ask our kids, what do you think about what this character did? Evaluate it, right? And you can obviously only do that so much with a 3 or 5 year old. But as they grow, if you've built those muscles in very, very simple ways, just did this honor God? What do you think? You know, giving them something simple like that, which depending on the situation could actually be very complex. But, you know, hopefully you're reading them simple stories in that way that they can tell the good guys from the bad guys most of the time. So that's great. And it's essential. I think a similar kind of thing that I've done sometimes is when they ask a question, instead of answering it right away, occasionally, if I know the story and I know where it's going, I might say, wait, you just listen and listen and you'll learn the answer to that question. And I want them to pay attention to what's coming on the next page or two. And then I tell them, you know, afterwards, if you do that, you do need to remember to come back to the question and say, okay, now you asked this question. Now that I've read, you should know, or you should be able to get something close to the answer. What do you think based on what I kept reading? Because a lot of times they're anticipating where the story is going, and that's why those questions come up. And they just need a little bit of patience to hear it for themselves and process it. And they'll hold on to those truths in a really profound way.
Yeah, I think this might be a good note to end on, but what you just said, I think, gets at the maybe the kernel of all of it, which is we're reading our children's stories, we're giving our children stories so that they know where they fit in the big story, so that they can submit to the big story. And so teaching them to read stories is for the end of teaching them to read God's story, and teaching them to read God's story as written in the scriptures, but also as written large in their lives. And by saying to them, what do you think? You're saying, read the story and tell me and analyze it. And that's building the muscle that they will need to read stories for themselves, which is what they will need to be able to read their own story and navigate it well. But then also, I love what you said, wait. Right? So often we want to just, no, give me the answer. I don't want to submit to the story. But saying to them, wait, submit to the story. It will come. Teaches them to do that in their own lives, right? Submit to the story. Wait. And that's why we're teaching them how to read. That's why we're giving them good stories. It's so that they can be faithful before their God, who's the storyteller. Like that's what it comes down to.
That's absolutely right. And one kind of final, maybe practical tip that will lead us very seamlessly into the end of the podcast is that's something we do in community. That's something we do together. And so ask other parents what stories they read to their kids, right? Look for recommendations. And on that note, what recommendation do you have for us for your book today, Josh?
Oh my goodness, that was seamless. My recommendation this week is Planet Narnia by Michael Ward, which is one of the most delightful books that I have read in my adult life. I say it's one of my favorite books, or one of the most delightful books. I finished it and I was like, nah, that was like 11 of the best books I've ever read, because it taught me to read the Seven Chronicles of Narnia and the three, you know, the space trilogy in a totally different way. So I won't spoil it entirely, but I will give you the premise. Planet Narnia is making the case, and it's a fairly academic work. It's well researched and scholarly, but it's making the case that C.S. Lewis intended to, with his fictional work, particularly with the Chronicles of Narnia and the space trilogy, he intended to try to capture and breathe into the modern period the seven medieval planets. So this medieval conception of the heavens was connected to, it's kind of hard to put a finger on, and he actually spends some time in the book describing the finger he's trying to put on it. Like, how do we even talk about this? But it really is like an atmosphere, like a breath. So the breath of Jove, the breath of Mercury, of Saturn, of Venus, right? And he's trying to, so Ward argues, I think compellingly, that Lewis is intentionally breathing that air into the modern world by his fiction. And specifically, that the seven Chronicles of Narnia correspond to the seven medieval planets. And I'll leave it there. It's wonderful.
Yeah, he actually came to ACCS this summer and gave a presentation on Planet Narnia. I went, and it was great. I missed the first maybe 10 or 15 minutes, but it was really good. And it's a book I've heard of and know enough about to know that I think I agree with him without having actually read the book and gone back through the Chronicles of Narnia, particularly with that in mind. But it's all over the space trilogy, obviously, because he calls the gods by name. And it's clear there, and I think it is maybe not as clear, but present still in Narnia.
And what Ward argues, again, I think compellingly, is that what he does heavy-handedly in the space trilogy, he does with far more subtlety and more effectiveness, actually, in Narnia. So it's really interesting. Like, he says, okay, he tried to do it in the space trilogy, but, you know, it's kind of clunky. And here's how he did it with more subtlety.
Yeah, that's great. My recommendation is a children's book, so not academic in the slightest. I figured this would be a good episode to drop a children's book recommendation. So The Kitchen Knight is a retelling of Sir Gareth, which is one of the Knights of the Round Table, one of my favorite Knights of the Round Table. And it's retold in this edition by Margaret Hodges, illustrated by Trina Shart Hyman, who's well known for her illustrations. They're just gorgeous. It's thorough. It's a good story. It takes a little while to read, maybe a good 10, 15 minutes or so, which means it's engaging. It's got many of the details. It's got a lot of the depth and the richness of the actual story itself. And the boys just love it. We have the St. George and the Dragon also by her, by Margaret Hodges, illustrated by the same illustrator. And those books are high up on the list, like they're top five easily for books that they want to read all the time. So I commend it to you. It's excellent. And give it a read. You can probably find somebody reading it on YouTube, and you can see the pictures and see kind of what the story's all about before you buy it if you really want to. But it's a great book, and the boys love it. I mean, they pretend to be Sir Gareth all the time. Like, if they have a sword in their hand, 50% chance they're Sir Gareth. And they're going out to fight the red knight of the red lawn or the blue knight of the blue lawn or the black knight of the black lawn. You know, they embody this story and kind of live it out in their play. And it's fantastic.
Yeah, the kitchen knight is solid gold. In fact, this is a good reminder. We read ours to pieces and it's gone. And so we need to get a new copy. But yeah, the Kitchen Knight and St. George and the Dragon, both solid gold. Yeah.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you for listening to the show. If you enjoyed the show, please feel free to share it with a friend. If you're interested in what we're writing about, you can see the link to our Substack in the description of the podcast below. We also want to say thank you to Shane Caver for the use of our theme music. You can find a link to his music in the show notes as well. And on that note, we hope you've been blessed and edified by the show.
Don't be hasty.
It is potent, and that was a weird pronunciation.
Potent.
Yeah.